You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Thursday, September 23rd. For 69 years, Cleveland has honored some of the finest writers the world has ever had the pleasure to read. Toni Morrison, Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, and Martin Luther King all make the list. Each has received the literary award named for Cleveland poet and philanthropist Edith Annisfield Wolfe. In 1935, Annisfield Wolfe established these awards for the books which that year best represented the richness of human diversity or exposed the horrible truths of racism. This year, another treasure trove of writers is welcomed into the company of Annisfield Wolfe as they stand to receive this prestigious literary award later today at the Cleveland Museum of Art. The ceremony is free and open to the public. And here on Around Noon, we continue our long-standing tradition of acting as the welcoming committee for the awards. Later in our show, we'll hear from one of the nonfiction award winners, there was a tie this year, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, author of Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. And I'll also have the honor of speaking with this year's Lifetime Achievement winner and Nobel Prize winner, Derek Walcott. But first, with me now in the studio are the two other winners, one fiction, one nonfiction, but both men chose the same topic, slavery in America. I'm joined by Edward P. Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Known World, and Guggenheim fellow Ira Berlin, the author of Generations of Captivity, A History of African-American Slaves. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me, and welcome to Around Noon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Berlin, let's begin with you and talk about what it is about the days of slavery that has long fascinated you.
Well, slavery is ground zero for American race relations. It's where we begin as a people. Slavery is central to our economy. Slaves grew, of course, the great staples which brought wealth into this country, tobacco, rice, sugar, eventually cotton. The people who grew that those crops and controlled the slaves were able to transform their great wealth into political power. If we take a look at the political power between the founding of the Republic and the Civil War, the presidents, the majority of them are slave holders, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Jackson, so on. They were able to take their position in American society and to give us a great ideal. Slaveholders thought that freedom was particularly important. And of course, a slaveholder wrote the founding document of American nationality, where he states perhaps our most important principle as a people, all men are created equal. And it's no accident that a slaveholder does that, which creates, of course, the great complexity for us as a people, people who are dedicated to equality. But for most of our history, we're a slave society.
Mm. Edward, you approach the topic from a different angle, tackling it in a novel, and you look at a forgotten part of slavery, blacks owning blacks. How did you come to that side of the story?
Well, in 1991, after I'd finished my first book, I suppose I was looking around for something else to do. The creative mind, I suppose, abhors a vacuum. And I remember this tiny fact from when I was in college decades before that there had been black people who were slave owners. And so I began thinking, and one day I woke up and there was this man on his deathbed, and he was a very young man, and he owned some 33 slaves. And I began to fashion this novel in my head around this man and this house he was living in and the county he was living in.
Did your characters, like the real-life people that Professor Berlin just described, build a foundation of wealth based on the slaves that they held?
This man, yes, but his wealth came from before he'd even known one slave in the novel. He was a bootmaker, a shoemaker, and that's how he accumulated his wealth. And so he went on from there to purchase a number of slaves, but as it happened, they didn't give him the wealth that I think he thought they would.
Hmm. how, Professor Berlin, did you integrate the history of slavery into the larger story of life in America at that time? I guess I'm asking, is slavery the most defining issue of that period of American life?
I think slavery does shape American society, certainly for the from the beginning right down to the Civil War, and then, of course, cast a long shadow after that. Slavery is the dominant institution, the most productive institution in American society. It's the great generator of wealth. It becomes a standard for how you organize society, how you think about social relations. That is, that model of master and slave reflects upon, and I think does in Edwards' book, reflects the relationships between husbands and wives and parents and children and masters and journeymen and ultimately, of course, rulers and ruled, so that the social relations that are produced by slavery are not simply contained in the relationship between master and slave, but in some ways become suffuse throughout the society. And of course, opposed to that, there's a counter relationship. And of course, it's around that the great conflict will take place in American society.
Edward, both you and Professor Berlin tell your stories across generations of characters, his in real life, yours fictional. I wanted to have you sketch an outline of your story, where it begins, where it ends, that is, in terms of a time frame.
Yeah, it's not really told in any chronological order. It begins in 1855, Virginia, in this imaginary county, Manchester. And the man I spoke about earlier, Henry Townsend, is dying in those first pages. In the room with him is his wife and the woman who was his teacher and his wife's maid. Then it sort of goes forward for the next two or three, 4 months about what happens after Henry dies, what happens to his plantation, to his wife, and their slaves. In the meantime, in telling all of this, I'm sort of jumping, I go back somewhat, and I go forward sometimes as far as 100 years into the future.
Hmm. Was there a certain amount of research that you had to do to lend the authentic background to this book?
Yeah, I had about 40 books, including two or three by Professor Berlin. Hmm. And one of them I had read previous to even thinking about writing a novel. It wasn't the one about free blacks, though. I was intending to read that as well as the other 39 books. I started thinking about this in 91, 92, and my intention was to read all of those books and then sit down and write the novel. And I would pick up one book. I remember one in particular, The Negro in Virginia. And I would read 20 or 30 pages, and my heart simply wasn't in the research. I could never, I suppose now, realize I could never be a historian. And so for 10 years, I just kept putting off. I would pick up the same book, for example, year after year and read those same pages. You would have to go back to the beginning because I would have forgotten what I had read previously. And so for those 10 years, I put all of this off. In the meantime, my mind was creating this novel in my head. I thought that I couldn't sit down and do any writing until I'd done the research. But my mind was creating this book in my head so that when I did sit down after some 10 years in 2001, I had 5 weeks of vacation with the day job I had at that time. And I thought, okay, I'll begin in earnest on reading all of these books. Well, my heart wasn't in it, so I just sat down and started writing. And what I realized long after everything was done is that if you're writing about human beings, about characters, you know, in a fictional way, the research, the history and everything should be in the background. The human character should always be in the front. What I realize is that you can go a long way with a little fact here and a little fact there. It's always the important thing are the people in the front.
I think if I could add, you can go a long way if you have, I think what Edward Jones has is extraordinary historical imagination. By that, I mean an imagination which can take us to the past and give us a sense of I think, something historians strive for but have very difficult time attaining, and that is a sense of the texture of life, the feeling for what it's like to be there. And I think that's one of the truly great things about the known world. He gives us a sense of the texture of these people's lives in his imaginary county.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the commentary here.
I think historians are sort of limited by the facts. The nice thing about being a fiction writer is that you can make up your own facts.
Sometimes historians are not limited by the facts, I should say.
Glad you put that in there, too. I am here with two of the winners of the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. Joining me in the studio, Edward P. Jones and Ira Berlin. We'll take a short break, and we'll come back to talk more with them as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
Wander through hidden tunnels of the Terminal Tower, go underneath a Cleveland Bridge, and revisit Euclid Beach. It's all Our Town, A to Z, tonight at 8 on WVIZ PBS Idea Stream.
The Obama Theater proudly presents the Ohio premiere of Ears on a Beetle by Mark St. Germain. Two FBI agents conduct undercover surveillance on John Lennon in a thought-provoking look at life in the 70s. Then as now, the playwright says there were no secrets in America but the truth. Ears on a Beetle, directed by Chuck Cartali, now through October 10th at the Obama Theater, 1846 Coventry in Cleveland Heights. For tickets, 216-932-3396.
Welcome back. You're tuned to Around Noon. I'm Dee Perry, and I'm here with Professor Ira Berlin, author of Generations of Captivity, and Edward P. Jones, author of The Known World. Each will receive the Annisfield Wolf Book Award tonight at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And do stay with us, because the other two winners, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc and Derek Walcott, join us later in the hour. Meanwhile, Professor Berlin, you're no stranger to awards, but I'm wondering if the Annisfield Wolf has a special cachet for you.
Well, if you take a look at the pedigree of the Annisfield Wolf Award, you can, it's extraordinarily intimidating. And it's great to be in such wonderful company of people whose work I have read and learned from and admired, work which I think every author strives with. It has lasted, had long tenure that people continue to read, and if you look into the kind of family tree of the Annisfield Wolf Award, you see lots of folks, it's a pleasure to be among them. Real honor.
The award is given around writing that helps promote understanding between races and cultures. I'm wondering how you think your book addresses that set of topics.
I think that slavery's been over now for, over 140 years. One would think, it's gone, 13th Amendment. There are people who, try to restart slavery in various forms, despite their enormous efforts on slavery's behalf, they're really never able to do it. So the question is why such great interest in slavery, not simply in the book, my book, but in many other things, both in terms of popular culture, movies like Glory and Amistad, television series, museums, whole museums of slavery. We now have the Underground Railroad Museum in Cincinnati, $100 million. And, of course, a variety of political questions, apologies, the big question of reparations. I think there's a real effort now of the American people to come to terms with the institution of slavery. And it has to do with trying to sort out our race relations. A lot of things that we thought were solved, addressed in the 1960s, turns out not to be have addressed. Many of the solutions we thought we came up with in the 1960s, most prominently affirmative action, have turned out to be politically unacceptable to a later generation. The problem of race clearly much with us in many different forms. We, in some ways, are a more segregated society than we were in 1956. I think people of goodwill are concerned about this, and when we have a concern about slavery, a concern about race, it takes us back to the question of slavery. As I said in my opening remarks, ground zero in many ways for trying to understand how we got to where we were. And I don't think we can address our concerns about race without addressing in some way slavery. I think that may be the connection.
Edward, I want to have you address the same question, but from another point of view, do you see America ever truly being free of its history of slavery?
Well, I think if there's a segment of history you want to be free of, you first have to delve into how you got there in the first place. And this country isn't really known for being an introspective place. I mean, there's a problem, and they think, well, maybe next state they correct it one day. They get up the next day, and they go on with whatever it is they had planned all along. So I think one of the reasons probably why we're still in the same state we're in 1956, even 100 years before that, is that slavery came and then it sort of ended, but it didn't end. I know that, you know, from that few years after the end of the Civil War, a lot of people were still enslaved, you know, and that's because there wasn't the will in this country to always do the right thing, which is why you can have people like the founders who can say all men are created equal, and yet they go home and be attended to by slaves. The country is full of contradictions, and they never want to work those out.
Hmm. What do you think the dialogue around your books can help to do to further the conversation?
I'm not sure about mine because I didn't have any sort of issues. I didn't have an agenda. There was just these characters, these people, and I set out to develop a story around them. It's only after the book is out there and people say, well, you know, we can talk about this and talk about this based on what you have in your book. But I really can't do that because all I know are the characters in the book and they're fictional people. They're made up. They weren't based on any other human beings ever who ever lived. So I'm not sure if I can contribute to any sort of dialogue. Other people will have to do that. I'll just do fiction. That's all I can do.
And that's not a bad thing because I think in the best fiction, and yours is among that, it opens a window into a world, fictional though it may be, that gets people to thinking about the issues. One reason why we're sitting in the studio having this conversation today. And for you, Professor Berlin, same question.
Well, I mean, I think that if the way you posed it, will it address certain questions? I think, you know, history is not something, you know, ultimately, you know, we solve, we deal with, and then we go on. It's just there. I think we're trying very hard as a people, struggling in the kind of awkward way that, you know, people do to come to terms with much of our past, a part of our past, which I think we're uncomfortable with and have a good, you know, there's a good reasons for us to be uncomfortable with. And I think that's a very healthy thing. I think also that if in fact we do come to terms with it in some sense, it doesn't mean it's over. It doesn't mean it's going away. It's still there. We have this heritage of being a slave society. That's an important part of our history. It's as much a part of our history as the things that we're very proud of. It's as much a part of our history as the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or the Gettysburg Address and all those things that we love to celebrate. And, you know, and it's right that we should celebrate them. But there are also parts of our history that, you know, probably most of us would just assume that it didn't happen. But it did happen. That's part of us too. Those things that we celebrate and those things that, you know, we wish hadn't happened, you know, make us a people. We've got to, you know, we've got to deal with it, and our children will have to deal with it, and our grandchildren will have to deal with it. It's not that it's going to be, you know, we'll address it once and, you know, we'll understand
it.
Problem solved. That's not the way history works.
But remembering it, that old saying, and something about doomed to repeat. Gentlemen, such a pleasure to have you both in the studio, and congratulations to both of you as well on your awards.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My guests have been Edward P. Jones and Ira Berlin, winners of this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. One of the two nonfiction winners was Ira Berlin for The Generations of Captivity, A History of African American Slaves. And fiction winner Edward P. Jones wrote The Known World, which also took home this year's Pulitzer. The Cleveland-based Annisfield Wolf Book Award starts its 69th ceremony at 5:30 later today at the Cleveland Museum of Art. That ceremony is free and open to the public. For more, visit today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, we'll meet the other nonfiction winner, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, author of Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. That's as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. It is 27 minutes before 1 o'clock as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Welcome back. You're tuned to a special edition of Around Noon as we welcome the 2004 winners of the Cleveland-based Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. Later today, four writers take home the award: Ira Berlin for Generations of Captivity, Edward P. Jones for The Known World, and Lifetime Achievement winner Derek Walcott. We've heard from both Berlin and Jones, and joining me now is the journalist who shares the nonfiction award with Professor Berlin, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, author of Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. Adrienne, thank you for joining us today, and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also, congratulations
thank
on your
you.
Award.
Thank you. It's really a fantastic honor.
What was the original inspiration for the book?
I was a young journalist in New York City, and as many young journalists do, I was covering the crime beat. And it was the late 80s, so I was witnessing a lot of young men in drug cases. And I became very interested in the impact of the drug dealing on their relationships with their mothers, basically, because some of these young men were the sole income earners in these families, poor families. And I was trying to figure out a way to write about the way in which that would affect a mother-son relationship, but also then became interested in how that affected sibling-to-sibling dynamics. So that's how I came into it. It really took its sort of own kind of turns at every step of the way. It kept changing, but that's what started me off.
Mm. It reads like a work of fiction because the story flows so seamlessly from person to person and event to event. And it's a really intimate portrait. What sort of access did you have to the people that you wrote about?
I spent 12 years sort of, I guess you would say, in the formal, although it was very informal research, with the people I wrote about. I met the initial young man, Boy George, in 1989, and I think the final writing ends in 2001. I think it is an intimate book, but I think perhaps what makes it appear more intimate than it may in fact be is that it's a book that has a lot about the domestic life of people who I think are more typically portrayed in terms of either social problems or crime or, yeah. You know, it sort of just shows poor people living their regular lives in the regular spaces where they in fact live them. So I think it may appear more intimate than...
In other words, you didn't move in, say, as a reality
show. Right. I did actually live with one of the young women for periods of time, and ended up spending a lot of time sleeping over, initially for very practical reasons, because I had a full-time job when I started, and I couldn't, so sometimes I would just be up there uptown so late that I would just stay over and get up and take the train down. And then I realized the importance of spending extended periods of time, both because I personally loved the work and the people that I was writing about, I became very close to, but also because I realized that the constant coming and going really changed my understanding of the cumulative toll of the stresses that were affecting people's situations.
You would miss hours of, say, some crisis or some
or
everyday
boredom.
Event.
I mean, the one thing that I always say I think is so insidious for, especially for young people, is the incredible boredom of poverty. I mean, there were moments where sort of things erupt and happen, but just relentless, the relentless grind of nothing to do and the feeling that it doesn't matter if you do anything, in the sense that nobody cares whether or not you're doing anything. So I think adolescence has its moments of boredom that any young people feel, but there's a kind of real obscenity and the kind of disregard for these kids that I think it really mattered that I was there for 14 hours rather than for two. Mm-hmm. So I began to understand things that I never could have. They certainly weren't things I could have asked questions about, and they certainly weren't things I could have appreciated unless I had felt the weight of that kind of time as well, and the exhaustion and the noise, and as often the beautiful things as well. But just there was some way that I had to at least approximate the experience a bit.
You write about, and it's even part of the title, the young men and women who have selling drugs as a main means of support. What did you see from them about how they looked on what they were doing?
That was a really tricky thing to untease, I think, in part because very early on, the moral dimension of that business ceased to be relevant. And it personally never interested me, the sort of moral question of drug dealing, because I think people have to survive and they figure out ways to do it. I'm not saying there's not a moral quotient to that question, but it doesn't really interest me. It only interests me if you choose to do it when, in fact, you have real
other options.
Vital options. I think it was very deeply connected to issues of the general shame around poverty that I think is probably pretty particular to, maybe it's not solely particular, but it's particular to Americans, because there's this whole climate of personal responsibility in pulling yourself up and all that. So in fact, if you are stuck, then it must be your fault. So I think the shame sort of traversed the drug dealing in a complicated way that was also historically changing, because it was just at the moment where drug dealing was also becoming a culture that was being commodified and marketed by mainstream mm-hmm. music people. And so there was a strange way that what was, I think, previously a trickier kind of thing was becoming glamorized. It always had a glamour, but it was then becoming a commodity in and of itself. So I guess I don't really have an answer. I do know that the young people, I would say for the most part, there was a lot of shame around it. Hmm. I mean, there was a bravado and there was a defiance, and they certainly, and a pride perhaps in being able certainly to bring in money and buy people they love things they needed, and certainly enjoying being able to buy things themselves. But I think when it really came down to it, it was something that aroused a sense of shame.
Let's talk a bit about the specific characters. You concentrate on four in particular, although mm-hmm. many lives cross sections with theirs: Jessica and Coco, Boy George and Cesar. What was your relationship, or I guess perhaps more to the point, what was their relationship with each other? How did you see them interact?
Well, Boy George was already in custody when I met him, and so all of his interactions were bounded by being in prison, and he's since been sentenced to life without parole. So I never saw him in the free world. So his relationship with Jessica, who was his girlfriend, took place in courtrooms and in visiting rooms and by mail. Jessica soon was arrested as well, and by then I was following their story. So then she and George were connected through correspondence. I met Coco, who was Jessica's sister-in-law, because I needed somebody to take me around the neighborhood to show me places that Jessica and I had not gotten to by the time she was sent to prison. Then Coco became the center of my attention. Cesar, who is Jessica's little brother, was out in the free world for a while when I started, but was then arrested and sent to prison. So Coco was the only one who had any kind of mobility. She would visit Cesar and Jessica, and then there were lots of letters. Rarely did people have consistent access to phone service because of the cost of collect calls from prison. There were occasional phone calls, but primarily correspondence and visits. Mm. And they did write to one another and keep in touch. Lots of photographs were exchanged. Coco was really the person who in the outside world would take pictures of Jessica's children. Jessica had three little girls that she left behind. So Coco would go to parties and take pictures and try to sort of keep the outside part of life alive for Jessica, and which is how I actually met Coco at a birthday party for her daughter, because Jessica called me because I had a reliable phone and said, could you please go and give my daughter a birthday kiss and tell her I love her and I'm thinking about her. And I went to the party, and that's where I met Coco.
And watching your face when you talk about them, it looks as if you made a real emotional connection with the people that you were writing about.
I mean, there's, you know, 30 or 40 people in the book. I can't say I loved everyone, but I certainly came to love some of the main people very, very much so. And I grew enormously as a person just by spending time with them. I mean, I just grew. I mean, I remember thinking that when the book was done that I would somehow return to this, I don't know what life it was I imagined, but I sort of thought there's this book and then I'll get back to my life. And I think as I was writing it, it was so hard for me to stay away from seeing them because I had to sort of render them in my imagination, and it was a struggle not to actually see them and talk to them physically, that I realized that it had become, my life wasn't bounded in separate places. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a compartment that the,
right.
And that, I think just as a journalist, there's a very strong tendency to want to keep those lines up for all kinds of reasons that actually have to do with your own capacity to cope with some of the things that you see. And it really helped me, I think, just as a person to realize it's all one big mess most of the time. But I do. I care for them a lot.
Are they still a part of your life?
Everyone except for Boy George. He and I never had a kind of natural rapport. I mean, Cesar is still incarcerated, and so we talk a lot on the phone, and I visit him, you know, as often as I can. And Jessica is finally out of prison, and I see them. Yeah, I do. I mean, it's getting harder to keep up with the sort of details of everyone's lives, but it's more like on holidays or someone's birthday or a christening, I'll be there, but the sort of ups and downs I'm a little less attuned to.
As we tune into the pages of the book, what do you think the lives and the details have to say to us as a larger societal family?
Well, I guess that poverty, I mean, I just find it's such sort of an outrage, really, that how many people live in poverty, not only because of the fact of it is just appalling, that one of the richest countries in the world, and that we're, you know, sticking our nose in all kinds of other places with this idea that we have great answers when, in fact, our own people aren't cared for fairly. But to me, the greatest tragedy is the waste of specificity of all these young people, that clearly this country needs a big injection of life. And it's not just that Coco's children should go to a school that has toilet paper or that, you know, they should sleep in a safe place, but they have very specific gifts to offer this society that we actually need. So it's all this sort of the individuality of these people that is consumed by the grind of just getting through another day, and it gets blunted far too young. I mean, most of the time it still isn't blunted, but I just, to me, that's the great loss, is the creative capacities of these young people that are utterly unknown to us, absolutely unknown to us. And in terms of leadership, clearly we are in desperate need of new ways of thinking, and I feel that these are the people that probably have more insight into some of these things than the current crop of people that are dealing with them. So that's the thing I would hope for.
I really appreciate your opening a window into those lives. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you. Thanks for having me very much.
My guest has been Adrian Nicole LeBlanc, whose new book is called The Sorry, I just lost that. Random Family, Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. Adrienne receives her award later today at the Cleveland Museum of Art, as the ceremony begins at 5:30 and the ceremony is free and open to the public. We'll take one last break and be back with the winner of the Lifetime Achievement Award, who is also a winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Derek Walcott. You'll hear that as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Welcome back. You're listening to a special edition of Around Noon as we honor this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Award winners, who'll take home their prizes later today at the Cleveland Museum of Art. I'm Dee Perry. Joining me now here in Studio B is this year's Lifetime Achievement winner, poet, playwright, essayist, and painter Derek Walcott, the 1992 winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Derek Walcott, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you join us today, and let me say congratulations.
Thank you.
You were born in St. Lucia.
Yes.
Your writing is full of vivid descriptions of life in the tropics, but I found it interesting that it's not the glossy travelogue variety. One of the poems in a collection that I read, Midsummer, has a line, "I feed on its dust, its ordinariness." And it's a theme you repeat in other poems and essays. I'm wondering why you find the mundane miraculous.
Well, the mundane in the Caribbean, and not only for that reason, is visually miraculous because the beauty of each island is staggering sometimes. You come around a corner and you see the sea, the blueness of it, the brightness of the sky, the hills and so on. So that every day is a renewal of that physical beauty. But it's not only that. It's not just the beauty of the landscape. I think it is I think that's a function of poetry, that it takes what is unexpectedly celebrated for its simplicity, and that is what a lot of poets have done in terms of praising the thisness of something.
I like that. The culture of the Caribbean has helped make you the man and the artist that you are today. Would you say that's a fair statement? The culture of the Caribbean?
Has done what?
Has helped shape you into the man and the artist that you are today.
Yes, because like any other artist, that's my environment. But I think I was lucky in the fact that when I began to write very young, along with a whole generation, now published as writers, we were naming things for ourselves for the first time. We were not using the language or the echo of, say, British or American writers. We were trying to write a sound that came from our own mouths and hearts, and that that expression had to be worked at individually. The great thing about Caribbean literature is that the writers are very different. There's a whole variety of authenticity in the writers we're talking about. There could be an Indian writer like Naipaul, or a black writer like C.L.R. James, or, a woman writer would have her own viewpoint, etc. So all the cultural mix and racial mixture that's there in the Caribbean has made Caribbean literature very varied and rich.
Mm. As is your writing, even in terms of the different styles that you write, poetry and essays and plays, I'm wondering how each form that you write in says something different. I mean, is there a different, wellspring of ideas that you're trying to get into each one, or just different ways to say the same thing?
Well, the most exciting reality, I think, is in the fact that Caribbean islands are talking new languages, really, in their alleged dialects, but which are languages, and that those languages are fed by all the continents of the world, the Asiatic and the European and the Mediterranean. They're all present in the volatility of the Caribbean dialects, all languages, and that each one really has a different melody. Jamaican is different, very different to Barbadian, and Trinidadian is different to Montserrat or somewhere. And a writer is blessed or lucky to be able to have access to all that variety of, it's like having a huge orchestra at your disposal.
Mm. And so you see the different forms in which you write as instruments in that orchestra?
Yes, exactly, right.
I would love to have you at this moment play the instrument that is your poetry. Would you share something with us?
I'll read a piece from Homeros, which is the end of the long book, whose central character is a fisherman called Achille, otherwise Achilles. I sang of quiet Achille, Aphalabe's son, who never ascended in an elevator, who had no passport since the horizon needs none, never begged nor borrowed, was nobody's waiter, whose end, when it comes, will be a death by water, which is not for this book, which will remain unknown and unread by him. I sang the only slaughter that brought him delight, and that from necessity of fish, sang the channels of his back in the sun. I sang our wide country, the Caribbean Sea, who hated shoes, whose soles were as cracked as a stone, who was gentle with ropes, who had one suit alone, whom no man dared insult and who insulted no one, whose grin was a white breaker cresting, but whose frown was a growing thunderhead, whose fist of iron would do me a greater honor if it held on to my casket's oarlocks than mine, lifting his own when both anchors are lowered in the one island. But now the idol dies, the goblet is broken, and rainwater trickles down the brown cheek of a jar from the clay of Choiseul.
That was an excerpt from Homeros and written by the 2004 Lifetime Achievement winner for the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards, Derek Walcott, sharing his poetry with us today around noon in Studio B. Derek, you won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992 for what they called a poetic oeuvre of great luminosity, sustained by historical vision, the outcome of a multicultural commitment. Did being a Nobel laureate change anything about your life or the way people responded to your work?
What it changed about my life, luckily, was that it was quite a lot of money. So I was able to build a house that I liked on a little peninsula in St. Lucia, which is very beautiful in its location. But it didn't change the fact that you can have whatever prizes you get, including this one. And tomorrow morning when you face the blank paper, you know, there's nothing that can help you apart from yourself. The prize can't help. But I can't pretend that it is not something that, for me, conveys still a great amount of astonishment. Because sometimes you look at the, you know, faces of Nobel Prize winners in a calendar and you wonder what you're doing there and if somebody's going to find out that you shouldn't be there and you get out of there fast.
I don't think anyone would think that. But I'm wondering if, looking back on your lifetime's achievements, you can point to something that you say, I'm so proud I've used my time and my intellect to do that thing.
It's not so much the writing as the fact that I formed a company of actors in Trinidad particularly. My brother's dead now, but he was also very active in forming theater companies. So he ran a company in St. Lucia, and I founded one in Trinidad that's now 45 years old with terrific actors. And that's the happiest thing I've done in my life.
That's interesting. Do you act yourself, or were you just proud to be supporting?
You're always on. Not really, no, I don't act, no.
Not even at this moment. Looking forward, what are you most excited to be working on in the days coming?
I'm working on yet another version of a play, a musical about the steel band, which the Trinidad Theatre Workshop, which is what I started, the company I started, will do in Trinidad.
Excellent. I'm so honored that you would spend some time with us here in the studio. And again, congratulations on your latest award.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Derek Walcott has been my guest. He is the 1992 Nobel Prize winner for Literature, and tonight he takes home the Lifetime Achievement Award from Cleveland's Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. Joining him tonight are fiction winner Edward P. Jones for The Known World and the two winners for nonfiction. It was a tie between Ira Berlin for Generations of Captivity and Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc for Random Family. The Anisfield Wolf Book Awards are held later today, starting at 5:30 at the Cleveland Museum of Art, located in University Circle at 11150 East Boulevard. That ceremony is free and open to the public, and for more information about the awards and all of the winners, just log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at wcpn.org. We invite you to stay tuned for the next hour, during which you'll hear a conversation with former President Jimmy Carter, plus the wife of the late jazz giant John Coltrane. That's between 1 and 2 with Tavis and Friends. On Around Noon tomorrow, we'll look into the history of Ohio's role in the making of the American president, plus the vital organs of griot poet Sekou Sundiata at Tri-C. And if you'd like to let us know what you thought of today's show, you can do that by calling our listener line at 216-432-3694 or emailing us. The address is comments@wcpn.org. Our thanks today to technical producer Jeff Carlton. We had A-list assistance from Bridget Whalen, Kelly Cook, and Jim Golders. Around Noon is produced by Dave DiIorio. I'm Dee Perry. Good afternoon.